right, thank you. Let's see. I mentioned this last week, I think, but we do have this book in our library if anybody wants to check it out. It's a very recent, it's called Green Buddhism, Practice and Compassionate Action in Uncertain Times. So if anybody's interested, that. Okay. So this is our second class on Active Hope, Joanna Macy's book, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. And I'm going to pass out my premises again. So my premises are just kind of my starting points. You do not have to agree with them, but I'm kind of offering them as the basis for our discussion. My first premise is I believe we are in a climate and ecological emergency. Exactly the details of what might happen, what is due to what, whether our lives are going to be turned upside down in the next 10 years or 20 years or within the lifetimes of our children or grandchildren. You know, those are kind of the questions, not is our lifestyle going to be turned upside down? So it's kind of, you know, the writing's on the wall in many ways. The time has come, this is just my premise that I'm offering for this class, that time has come to shift the focus from green consumerism to working for systemic change. Not at all that our choices, our consumer choices, our diets are very, very important. But one of the traps that we've fallen into in the last 30 plus years in the environmental, whenever we talk about environmental things, we focus on our green consumerism and fail, therefore, we kind of get stuck there and we fail to talk about the systemic things that are going wrong that we need to look at and address. So my suggestion is just in this forum that for the time being we set aside those discussions of our consumer choices. Diet is huge, I know. But for one thing, those discussions always kind of devolve into debates about the details, and it just doesn't tend to be fruitful. So in some ways, it's almost like, you know, we all aspire to keep the precepts. We all know it's very difficult, and we kind of trust each other to be doing our own work on that. So part of the premises for this class. Three, our spiritual practice compels us to act for the welfare of all beings, and such action is inseparable from our spiritual practice. I don't know how you feel about that, but there has been a tendency through time, especially in Buddhism, to think of, you know, there's actions and activities and responsibilities you have out there, and then in here is your spiritual life, which is somehow separate. We take the Bodhisattva vow, and our well-being is not separate from the well-being of all. Four, in our efforts to bring about a life-sustaining society, the time has come for solidarity and inclusion. There is place for everyone in what Joanna Macy calls the Great Turning. So in that sense, you know, to be focusing on a, you know, book that talks about the issues in the world and how do we face them and how do we respond. And, you know, I think she does a really good job, and we're going to get there later, about expanding our ideas of what an activist is. She said an activist is somebody who is acting to bring about the world that they hope for in many different ways. So So in a way, I want to invite everybody. No, I don't. Or I want to invite everybody to consider themselves part of this discussion. That this, all of this is relevant, regardless of whether you go to demonstrations or you know whatever to think, you know, see in what ways this applies to your life. And also then to, in a similar way, just not to compare ourselves to each other or to even to our own ideals, but just to start where we are. So my hope is that our study of this book together and other things that might come up as we're going through it is, you know, like she says, how to face the mess we're in without going crazy. That's an important part of it. And that's part of what we're talking about today in the chapter on coming from gratitude. But I also hope that we find a way forward to act, to take some kind of action. Now, if you don't, I figured, you know, I wish I could just kind of see inside everybody's head, see where you are with all of this. But I figured I'd list a couple possibilities. Now, if you don't relate to this sense of urgency or need, you know, if a little bit, I'm like, okay, well, we're going to be studying this book, Active Hope, I don't know, whatever. I mean, I'm going to kind of miss, you know, studying Buddhist stuff for a while. You know, I mean, if you don't really relate to it, then I invite you to look at this as a chance to listen to, understand, and support your fellow Sangha members who do feel it, and also the people outside this room that do feel it. I think this is, well, I don't just think, this phenomenon of being very alarmed and concerned about our world is becoming a lot more common. There's a discussion in the psychological world about maybe defining something called climate anxiety, that actual, like, especially if you already have anxiety or depression and that feeds into, you know, the situation we're facing, and it, people can really, really can get grim. There's something that the people are defining as ecological grief, the grief felt in relation to experienced or anticipated ecological losses, including the loss of species, ecosystems, and meaningful landscapes due to acute or chronic environmental change. And then here's another one, solastalgia. So as opposed to nostalgia, solastalgia is, so nostalgia is for, you know, something that is past and gone and you're not around it anymore. Solastalgia is the distress that is produced by environmental change impacting people while they are directly connected to their home environment. So they're still in their home environment, but the home environment is changing. So traditions and of hunting or farming or whatever are being lost, and there's people are all over the world are starting to really not probably not even starting, but just it's becoming more and more clear how people are suffering from this. So if you look within you and you feel like you could or should, so this is the second possibility, I imagine, you feel like you could or should be doing more, then I'm hoping this course can be about exploring that feeling. How do we cope with potential overwhelm or pain when we open ourselves up and face the world's problems? How do we find some peace, joy, and equanimity, but without shutting ourselves off from the pain and suffering? How do we find something to do, something that matters? How do we sustain ourselves as we do it, given our busy and demanding lives? So these are the kinds of questions we'll be exploring in that way. And if you look within, and as much as you care about the well-being of the earth and other beings, you know you are doing as much as you can. Then I'm picturing this can also be a process for you to accept that. I mean, I think of there's people, you know, you're caring for other people, you're caring for children or elderly folks, or your health is a struggle and it's taking up so much of your time, you have no extra time or bandwidth or resources. Then I'm thinking, you know, this is an opportunity to connect with others and build up your faith that other people are acting. That we're all in this together. And even if you can't, you know, squeeze anything more out of your life, that you can start to connect with other people who are and feel some more hope. Okay, so just briefly, I wanted to revisit active hope, because at the beginning of one of the chapters that we're reading, there's a nice little kind of poetic description of active hope. So active hope, as she explained in the first chapter, is not hoping that something happens. It's not based on the likelihood that you think something is going to happen. It's deciding what kind of world you hope for, and then devoting yourself to that, to trying to make that come about. So it has to do with your intention, your hope for the world, as opposed to what you hope is going to happen externally. So she said, active hope is not wishful thinking. Active hope is not waiting to be rescued by the Lone Ranger or some savior. Active hope is waking up to the beauty of life, on whose behalf we can act. We belong to this world. The web of life is calling us forth at this time. We've come a long way and are here to play our part. With active hope, we realize that there are adventures in store, strengths to discover, and comrades to link arms with. Active hope is a readiness to engage. Active hope is a readiness to discover the strengths in ourselves and in others, a readiness to discover the reasons for hope and the occasions for love, a readiness to discover the size and strengths of our heart, our quickness of mind, our steadiness of purpose, our own authority, our love for life, the liveliness of our curiosity, the unsuspected deep well of patience and diligence, the keenness of our senses, and our capacity to lead. None of these can be discovered in an armchair or without risk. So, I find this concept very useful to other people, or if there's anybody out there who just like doesn't really get it.
We'll see.
Huh?
We'll see. We're here to learn about it.
I mean, does anybody feel like you have some experience of this already? I mean, maybe not in regard to climate change specifically, or ecological issues or whatever, but in the sense of not succumbing to depression or anxiety, but finding out what needs to happen and just moving forward.
Though, you know, I've been at this for a number of years, since the 60s. Osberg, Nature Conservancy, Valley Migrant League. Frankly, at 70, I'm tired. I'm weary. I'm almost depressed when I go at the university I taught, well, I didn't teach, but at the university where I worked, the students who came from out of state didn't have the sense to even recycle cans. Not for the nickels, just recycle the metal. They threw them in the garbage. And the Hispanic cleaning crew would come through and have another bag, and they'd go through and pick out the nickels. Are they up to a dime now? I think they're up to a dime now, right? And it was like, guys, do you understand? And it was like, right over the top of their head. The guys from Oregon and Washington, yes, they were there. They understood. But it's like, I feel like we're in this upper left-hand corner of the country bubble where we understand what's going on. We have a good view of the situation. And the rest of the nation, at least in my experience, is, you know, like, there's nothing on their radar. They don't. I go to Detroit, similar situation. Mm-hmm. And frankly, my wife and I are quite frustrated because people move into the neighborhood, they don't even recycle. Washington County has the little red bins, we have it's just really frustrating.
You know, as you're talking, I mean, I just feel my heart kind of going like, you know, I mean, once we start evaluating our chances, you know, judging how far we've come, you know, it's like however many steps forward, however many steps back, you know, it's, I guess that's where the hope can't come from there. The hope comes from, you know, if this is all, if we're all going to hell in a handbasket, how do I want to go down?
No, that's not what I said.
No. I'm not saying you said that. I'm saying that's what active hope is. Is saying, regardless of how dire the situation is, how little progress we're making, even if we're never going to solve this, even if we're never going to get this across and people aren't really going to change their ways, how do we want to live the rest of our lives?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just a little bit younger than you, but I remember the 60s, and how many people remember the population explosion? That was the big thing in the 60s, population explosion. You got to control the population. That was a big deal. You ever hear anyone talk about it anymore? Population is more than doubled. Remember the tipping point? I was talking a few years ago. We reached a tipping point. If we get past this level of CO2 in the atmosphere, we're past the tipping point. You hear that term anymore? Because we're past the tipping point.
Well, we are. I think so.
Oh, yeah.
I think
we are.
Scientists are calling this the sixth mass extinction.
Yeah.
The fifth one was when the dinosaurs disappeared. We are actively participating in the possible extinction of our own race.
Right. But I still recently cut beef pretty much out of the diet. Buy it no more than once a month.
We what?
It's a special treat. Beef.
Beef.
Beef is a horrid food as far as the environment goes. And lamb. They're the two worst. We kept that out. I watched how much I drive. I tried not to drive too much. Even though, quite honestly, I have lost faith in the human species being able to stop this. I still try to take the moral ground of not contributing to it excessively.
Okay.
I just got the book out of the library and I kind of cheat, you know, I look at how it's laid out. And even if she's talking about how to start a cooperative or whatever, the book is pretty awesome. I mean, just her format. And I've recommended it to people because, not for the title, but just the way it's set up. And she wrote it like, they wrote it like 8-9 years ago. So it's a real kick in the pants because it's so easy, all of us, if we're not depressed, we're not awake. But on the other hand, when I hear of what's coming out of mass media and news, that's not the team I'm on. So I don't care if I'm the only goat on the hill hollering. I don't care because, like Mary Oliver says, I've got one life and I'm not going to blow it. So I keep calling Kate Brown and saying, you know, I voted for you and when are you going to cough up? But the thing is, we're not that green. You like to think we are. We don't have rules like Washington State or California to protect our coastline from just the oil industry. So, and we don't have rules for just protecting species in our state. So it's just, it doesn't matter if we start comparing, you know, where we're at on the grid. It's not a bell curve. It's just, you know, we all have 24 hours in the day, and even if you do one thing, it's like a tapestry. While you're doing this little bit, somebody's over there doing that. And it's just...
I see this as a, it's a shift in where we put our attention. As long as we were put our attention out there, the task seems impossible. Impossible, depressing, overwhelming, discouraging. Anything you do seems like a little drop in the bucket. But if we shift our attention in here, then it can feel very clear. And I mean, imagine a natural disaster strikes your neighborhood and you don't know who's going to survive, if anyone's going to survive, the water's rising. What do you do? Do you be like, I don't think, look at all the water that's coming, you know, it's no point, we're all going to die anyway. I mean, you get up on your roof and you get your neighbor up on the roof and you do whatever you can. And as long as we stay focused on our response, are we responding with love? Are we fulfilling our, you know, living according to our conscience? There can be peace in that.
Yeah, to me it doesn't seem enough. But I know there's answers out there. There's a book I got out of the library called Drawdown by Paul Hawken. Like 100 things we could do to combat climate change, including people are out there creating machines or things to get carbon out of the air, to draw it out of the air. I mean, there's stuff these scientists are doing out there.
That's
gives
where
me hope, but yeah. I'm not sure. I still get depressed. I remember hearing 10 years ago, what if we knew like a big crater was going to come and land on the Earth and that was the end? Would we still work to make life better? No, it's all going to go. So sometimes I feel that way. But I know there's scientists out there and there's answers out there. But
well, this is, you know, thank you. You took me back to the next thing in her book, which... over the course of the book, she's going to go into each of these things in more detail, but the way she sees it, and I keep saying she, I guess I should say they, Macy and Johnstone, the way they see it is a spiral. So there's coming from gratitude, which we're going to talk about today, which gives us strength to honor our pain for the world, to face what's actually going on and not just kind of, you know, distract ourselves and turn away, to honor it, to feel it, to be with it. Then she calls it seeing with new eyes. And that's what you were talking about just makes me think of that. And I think this is ties in with our Buddhist practice so much. We don't realize in what ways we are stuck. We are stuck in our limited views. And there's so much more out there. most of us, how much research have we actually done into the options? All we know is what we've happened to encounter in whatever media we tend to consume, and, you know, so it's like, oh God, there goes another. We don't know. And the more research, and there's another book that I feel like maybe I should bring in and like pepper this in with what we're studying. I can't remember his name. I will be able to look it up. But a recently published book, and he basically talks about how a lot of things have gotten better. A lot of things have gotten a whole lot better. And he documents it throughout this whole book. We tend to focus on the negative, and of course, the thought that our planet might overheat and kill us is a big deal, but you know, I mean, he focuses on, we tend to focus on the negative. And just whatever, sure. I mean, the much less war is going on than ever went on before. There's much more democracy. There's much more equality. There's, you know, much less disease. All these kinds of things that he documents that, you know, we just blow off and forget about. Like, we haven't made any progress at all. And I only bring that up not to argue for it, but just, you know, our minds are limited. And to open up to new ways of seeing and doing, you know, these you see when there is a disaster, how people pull together. I mean, sometimes it's just like, geez, why can't we always be like that? You see people pull together and get to know their neighbor and help their neighbor, and you know, it. That kind of situation has its positive results as well. So that's her spiral then, is, and then seeing with new eyes and then going forth, finding a way to act in the world, to respond, to help in some way bring about the world that we hope for. That action, some kind of action, which again, we can think very creatively in terms of what that is, some kind of action is involved. So this isn't just sitting in our armchairs, you know, playing mental games so that we feel better. That it does actually, we have to participate. But then the spiral goes around, and then we need to come from gratitude again. So to get to that, she talks about cultivating gratitude. And how it promotes a sense of well-being, and therefore leads to generosity. He talks about a funny experiment where they left quarters in payphones, and then people would come and they'd make a call, but that, you know, oh cool, there was already a quarter. But then some people that, you know, had gone to the payphone and they didn't have a quarter. And then they set it up so that an experimenter outside the payphone box dropped a bunch of papers. And if a person had just gotten a free quarter, they were much more likely to stop and help the experimenter pick up their papers. So you just get this sense of, you know, you feel kind of grateful, and then you feel more generous. And I think we all relate to that. She talks about gratitude as an antidote to consumerism, with dissatisfaction of what we have and how we look. So it's kind of a sweet little practice that she has, they have. So I'll do it. Scan your recent memories and identify something that's happened in the last 24 hours that you were pleased about. It doesn't have to be anything big, just something that makes you think, I'm glad that happened. Close your eyes and imagine that you are experiencing that moment again. Notice colors, tastes, sounds, smells, and the sensations in your body. Notice also how you feel in yourself. Now, who or what helped this moment to happen? Was anyone or anything else involved? If so, think of them and imagine expressing your thanks. Did anybody feel a change of heart? Interesting. It was nice to think about this nice thing that happened, and then suddenly, like giving thanks, like shifted in a different way, kind of like from my enjoyment to like, wow. You know, I just had lunch with a friend today. I had lunch with Joshin. She and I drove out to see our retreat facility. We had lunch on the way back. It's like she was giving her time to come and grateful for her participation. And my husband supports me, so he paid for the car that got me there and bought my lunch. I'm grateful for that. The Sangha supports me. I'm grateful, you know, like suddenly it has a connecting sensation. Anyone else want to share? her point is that gratitude can help us face difficult stuff. It's kind of an antidote to despair. And she gives this example. To find our power, to see the hard parts of life clearly and respond constructively, we need to draw on resources that bring out the best in us. Gratitude does this. It's a resource we can learn to tap into at any moment. Here's an example. Julie had just seen the news. She felt outraged. A school in a refugee camp had been bombed, children killed, and she was so full of fury, she could hardly speak about anything else. Then for a moment, she thought of the reporters who covered this story. They had risked their lives so that she could be kept informed. The news editors may also have stuck their necks out, choosing to include this item rather than the latest celebrity gossip. As she thought about the steps they had taken, she felt grateful. Her gratitude reminded her she wasn't alone in caring about what happened. When violations and injustice occur, trust is often a casualty. Loss of trust makes it harder to experience gratitude, even when help is given. The distrustful part of us may wonder what the hidden agendas are. Trust levels are falling. Surveys show that people are about half as likely to trust others as they were 50 years ago. Will it be possible to turn the tide? Trust and gratitude feed each other. To deepen our capacity for thankfulness in difficult times, we need to learn from those who have mastered this quality. So now we're talking about gratitude as a practice. And I think some of you have, you know, heard about gratitude journals, you know, maybe at the end of the day, writing down some things that you are grateful for. And, you know, like the exercise just pointed to, doing something that shifts you toward that relationship. Now she's talking about learning from the Haudenosaunee, people, native, indigenous people from the U.S. In 1977, representatives traveled to a UN conference in Geneva, Switzerland. They had a warning and a prophecy to share. Their basic call to consciousness, as it is known, contained the following paragraph. The original instructions direct that we who walk about on the earth are to express a great respect, an affection, and a gratitude toward all the spirits which create and support life. We give a greeting and thanksgiving to the many supporters of our own lives, the corn, beans, squash, the winds, the sun. When people cease to respect and express gratitude for these many things, then all life will be destroyed, and human life on this planet will come to an end. So this is, you know, what they are calling coming from gratitude is a way to balance and anchor and sustain ourselves. I mean, we all know we need something. If we try to get our minds around the problems in the world to face them, that's just, it quickly becomes overwhelming. We have to have some way to have the strength and equanimity to face these situations, to balance. We need joy and relaxation. I mean, this is one of the things that I'm appreciating about, as some of you know, I've been getting involved with Extinction Rebellion, and they try to make an effort. They call it regenerative culture. They try to incorporate a sense of joyousness and art and beauty and humor and things like that into the efforts, because otherwise it's just not sustainable, and it's just sad and depressing. So if we see gratitude and sincere joy as necessary ways to sustain our efforts to help, our efforts to bear witness, then our joy doesn't have to stand in opposition to the suffering. So I don't know about you, but I've had a very ambivalent relationship to my life and my fortune in many ways. I've always been aware that there are people suffering in such excruciating ways. How can I just, you know, shut that out and enjoy a sunny day in my garden, you know? But I wonder if our practice can let us tolerate this ambiguity, let both of these sides be present at the same time, so that we're not enjoying in spite of. But if we know our practice involves trying to bear witness, trying to respond, we know our practice is going to incorporate that aspect of it, then we can also enjoy. So it's like a more of an and. So rather than even though there are children imprisoned in this country right now in inhumane conditions simply for crossing our border, I'm going to enjoy this lunch with my friend. You know, then there's this tension. Or can we say, my heart aches because there are children being imprisoned, and I am enjoying my lunch with my friend? I mean, can we hold both in our hearts? I think, I mean, in a way that has to be, if we're not just going to try to deny and turn away and distract ourselves, then we have to find a way to hold both. We have to find a way to find sincere and complete joy, which we've seen, you know, in so many of our admired spiritual leaders. I mean, it's difficult for me to imagine someone who can take more sincere joy in something than the Dalai Lama. I recently shared on Facebook, my husband found this post of, I think it was, it was Dr. John, the jazz, the blues singer, and he's like playing, and the Dalai Lama is standing nearby. They were both at some, you know, event, and the Dalai Lama's just like, I mean, he was just like, oh, that's so cool. And then, you know, think of the Dalai Lama's history. You know, and then there's Thich Nhat Hanh, who's been through so much. And, you know, he will encourage you to, you know, take in sublime joy in orange. You know, I really wanted to, you know, so how does this relate to Buddhism? What does Buddhism have to say about cultivating gratitude? And I was honestly really like, I can't think about any Buddhist teachings about cultivating gratitude. Weird. Like, I realized it's just not, it's not really something, I mean, it's got, Buddhism has no problem with gratitude. It doesn't say, you know, whatever you do, don't be grateful, but it just, it doesn't make it on the list of the Brahma Viharas, you know, goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. It doesn't make it onto the paramitas, you know, generosity, morality, concentration, effort. I just think it's, but on the other hand, Buddhism does have a very strong tradition of cultivating certain attitudes and qualities, such as metta, such as goodwill, because of their beneficial results. So it's not in all a stretch to like cultivate gratitude because of the effects that it has on our mind and body, and allows us to, you know, feel connected to, feel strengthened, all of these things. So I was thinking, like, is it just because it's a non-theistic tradition, so there's no God, that we're thanking for stuff? I don't know. Or maybe it's just, you know, it's always had this emphasis on non-materiality, so I don't know. So go figure. But it's a living tradition. So perhaps now is the time for emphasizing gratitude because of how our societies have become dominated by greed and individualism and a sense of separateness and competition. So, you know, we also have a tradition of skillful means, which is, you know, kind of whatever works. Whatever works to bring suffering beings, you know, to greater happiness and peace and wisdom. So, I feel like Thich Nhat Hanh talks about gratitude. So, you know, it's great then, you know? Gratitude has made its way into Buddhism if Thich Nhat Hanh's doing it. So I just wanted to leave you with his, I don't know, like there's this tension in religious traditions where, I mean, you wanna stick to what's in your tradition to a certain extent because it's time tested. We've built up our relationship to it. We've built up our trust in it. All the teachings are related. So if there's, you know, teaching, it has related practices and teachings. And so you don't just willy-nilly add new stuff to it. Well, I think we should do this. I think we should meditate like this. I think, you know, it's just usually that stuff just doesn't really last or have that much of an impact. On the other hand, you know, there's this balance. Like, we don't want it to become a dead tradition either. Like, well, we don't cultivate gratitude in Buddhism. Like, you know, I mean, come on. If it's useful, if it's time for us to pay more attention to the earth specifically, then let's do it. Yeah.
The poet in me uses the word honoring, kind of gratitude. Mm-hmm. Honor nature and living things. And if they say haphazard talk, you don't need, forget fault finding. So what's left, you know, I mean, I'm not bowing to myself. I'm bowing to the unhoused person I sat on the bench next to. The other day, and you know, we just kind of sat there together, so it doesn't matter. Gandhi said, find joy in the fight, not the result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I will leave you with this piece by Thich Nhat Hanh from his Love Letters to the Earth. says, "We can't wait any longer to restore our relationship with the Earth, because right now the Earth and everyone on the Earth is in real danger. When a society is overcome by greed and pride, there is violence and unnecessary devastation. When we perpetrate violence against our own and other species, we're being violent toward ourselves at the same time. When we know how to protect all beings, we will be protecting ourselves. A spiritual revolution is needed if we're going to confront the environmental challenges that face us. Real change will happen only when we fall in love with our planet. Only love can show us how to live in harmony with nature and with each other and save us from the devastating effects of environmental destruction and climate change. When we recognize the virtues and talents of the Earth, we feel connected to her and love is born in our hearts. We want to be connected. That is the meaning of love, to be at one. And when you love someone, you want to take care of that person as you would take care of yourself. When we love like this, it's reciprocal. We will do anything for the benefit of the Earth, and we can trust that she, in turn, will do everything in her power for our well-being." And then, this is one of his love letters to the Earth, which is meant to be something of a meditation. So I just love this. Like, I would never have the balls to just, you know, write a Buddhist letter to the Earth. "Oh, Mother Earth, I love you." But Thich Nhat Hanh did it, so that's okay. "Dear Mother Earth, I bow my head before you. As I look deeply and recognize that you are present in me and that I'm a part of you. I was born from you and you are always present, offering me everything I need for my nourishment and growth. My mother, my father, and all my ancestors are also your children. We breathe your fresh air. We drink your clear water. We eat your nourishing food. Your herbs heal us when we're sick. You are the mother of all beings. I call you by the human name Mother, and yet I know your mothering nature is more vast and ancient than humankind. We are just one young species of your many children. All the millions of other species who live or have lived on Earth are also your children. You aren't a person. But I know you are not less than a person either. You are a living, breathing being in the form of a planet. Each species has its own language, yet as our mother, you can understand us all. That is why you can hear me today as I open my heart to you and offer you my prayer. Dear Mother, wherever there is soil, water, rock, or air, you are there, nourishing me and giving me life. You are present in every cell of my body. My physical body is your physical body. And just as the sun and stars are present in you, they are also present in me. You are not outside of me, and I am not outside of you. You are more than just my environment. You are nothing less than myself. I promise to keep the awareness alive that you are always in me, and I am always in you. I promise to be aware that your health and well-being is my own health and well-being. I know I need to keep this awareness alive in me for both of us to be peaceful, happy, healthy, and strong. Sometimes I forget, lost in the confusions and worries of daily life. I forget that my body is your body, and sometimes even forget that I have a body at all. Unaware of the presence of my body and the beautiful planet around and within me, I'm unable to cherish and celebrate the precious gift of life you have given me. Dear Mother, my deep wish is to wake up to the miracle of life. I promise to train myself to be present for myself, my life, and for you in every moment. I know that my true presence is the best gift that I can offer to you, the one I love. Few minutes left. Does anybody want to say anything? Or
thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of 10. He has 10 letters to the earth. Mm-hmm. I've been asking myself, you know, what does, in a way, what does all of this have to do with Zen and Buddhism? Because sometimes, you know, people come to a Zen center and they don't want to hear about, like, love letters to the earth. They want to hear about, you know, Zen and Buddhism. And yet, I feel like, if our practice doesn't have to do with all of this, then I don't think it's much of a practice.
Most, at least on this particular discussion tonight, I don't have a difficulty connecting Buddhism to what we're talking about at all. One of the first things a teacher asked me, and I never could understand what she was talking about. It had to do with an aspect of my own character, which I am frankly ashamed of. But could I hold it? And I'm still not 100% sure I totally get what that is, but I know what it means for me. And what I heard you talk about, you know, joy with being with your friend, and at the same time deep sadness for children in some hard detention center. I mean, I have to ask myself, can I hold those two things together? And my mind immediately went to faith and mind. The way is not difficult as long as we don't pick and choose. So I appreciate the constant link to Buddhism, but I don't necessarily find that a stretch.
Well, thanks. If anybody else finds ways that you know, the practice in an explicit way ties in somehow, I mean, that's what I feel like Green Buddhism, she goes into this, and then David Loy just has a book out called Eco Dharma, and I think both of them go into all the different ways that our practice talks about, you know, why we should care for the earth and how and all that stuff. But I like Joanna Macy's formulation because it's just so practical. So in a way, maybe it's kind of like both she and Thich Nhat Hanh were just like, whatever. Let's just, you know, who cares about making it like Buddhist? Let's just make it how it's most useful. And obviously both of them are deeply inspired Buddhists. So
Buddhism. years. So it has gone from culture to culture to culture at time to investor. So it's got to be there. Because it has survived for 2,500 years as things have changed. They have the resiliency to change. Yeah.
And to respond to new, mm-hmm. new needs and circumstances. So,
I mean, the current crisis is probably 500 years in the making. And its precepts were there long before that. Buddhism meant to spring.
I think it's a good idea not to kill. You know, that probably has been around a really long time. Well, that's 9:00. Thank you all very much. Thank you.